Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. I'm very fortunate this week to have back on the show Reverend Mark Dankoff. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Patrick.
So there's really a lot to talk about. There's so much going on in the international arena, and you are absolutely my go-to person when it comes to world affairs. Before we get to the world affairs, a lot of what's going on is things that we were hoping we wouldn't have to deal with a few months ago after Donald Trump was elected and eventually inaugurated. This was the type of thing that we thought we were avoiding by electing Donald Trump. And during the early days of his presidency, I saw some hopeful signs. There were troublesome signs, too. What was he doing appointing Nikki Haley as U.N. ambassador, somebody who had opposed him during the election, somebody who's just been a very reliable Zionist mouthpiece to the extent that she has any experience in foreign policy, which is none other than going to a Marco Rubio rally or something like that. So there were some worrying signs, but I thought the appointment of General Flynn in particular, somebody who seemed to not have this agenda against Russia, and Rex Tillerson, I thought that was probably about as good as could be hoped for. I was worried about Mattis, but during the first couple of months of Donald Trump's administration, up until the very beginning of April, even the very beginning of April, Donald Trump said overthrowing the Syrian government is not an objective. And then within 2 days, we had this missile strike against Syria, which really demarcates a great change in the administration. Something I've referred to as a palace coup, a coup d'etat, or even a Jew d'etat, because it does seem to be perpetrated by a largely Jewish clique within the administration. What's your take on it? Do you think that we were just all mistaken in the first place, or do you think that something fundamentally shifted within the administration sometime around a month ago?
That's a $64,000 question, and to tell you the truth, I'm not sure. I don't know whether this guy Trump has been a fraud from the beginning or whether he has simply been co-opted by some extremely bad advice, but nonetheless, he is the person that has put all of these people in the places that they presently occupy, whether you're talking about McMaster or you're talking about Mattis or you're talking about Tillerson or you're talking about Nikki Haley that you've already mentioned, the so-called UN ambassador. These are a group of people on the whole that represent a point of view that is not the point of view of people like us who voted for Donald Trump. Robert Perry has a very, very interesting piece out. It came out on the 25th of April for Consortium News, and it's entitled Donald Trump's Failing Presidency. The summation of the article at the beginning says, after his election, Donald Trump had a narrow path to a transformational presidency, but it required breaking the neocon grip on U.S. foreign policy and telling the truth to citizens. Already Trump has failed, says Robert Perry. And he goes on to buttress that thesis statement with a series of examples. But it does seem to me that what you have with Donald Trump is a situation where Israel and Saudi Arabia seem to be leading Trump's key foreign policy advisors around by the nose. And then, of course, Trump continues doing a series of things, none of which are good. I think that the worst example of that yet is the bombing of Syria on April 7th, which you went into in some little bit of detail. We might discuss that a little bit further. But when we start looking at other things that have been going on, we're now hearing stories that the United States is getting ready to put another 5,000 boots on the ground in Afghanistan, that we're going to buttress our forces in Helmand Province in Afghanistan, that we're going to continue building up with boots on the ground in Syria, which is exactly the wrong thing to be doing, at least in my perspective. And when it comes to our policy with Russia, it seems to me that what has been transpiring, especially in Syria, is a foreign policy that is not only not America first, but it virtually guarantees that we're going to be on some sort of a confrontation or a collision course with Russia, which is exactly what we felt we were not going to be getting if Donald Trump was elected. And we had North Korea to the mix of this, and it's an extremely serious situation. And I don't like the looks of it at all. And, of course, when you read Robert Perry's analysis of this in Consortium News, it's pretty apparent that the key people that surround Donald Trump, several of whom have been in daily contact, we're told, with the legendary neocon Paul Wolfowitz, suggests that the Trump presidency is looking a lot worst aspects of the Bush Empire, the Clinton Empire, or the Barack Obama regime in regard to the mistakes we keep making. The increasingly favorable outlook that several adversarial people have of the Trump presidency is another sign that things are going wrong. I'm referring chiefly to John McCain and Lindsey Graham, of course, but others, including Wolfowitz himself, have been, as of late in terms of public statements, quite laudatory to the Trump administration for doing all of these allegedly wonderful things that people like you and I have been saying from the beginning was the cause of much of what has happened in the Middle East, the cause of American problems in the Middle East, and these people simply want more of it. And thus far, the president seems to be moving in exactly the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is the $64,000 question, whether this was really a policy shift or just more of a disrobing of election rhetoric and exposing the real Donald Trump. I do think it is most likely a policy shift aimed at his political survival. I think that he is new to politics, and the last time we spoke, we were talking about the appointments he had made as of that point, and we talked about the fact that because he's an outsider, and he's an outsider from the business world, whereas somebody, for instance, like Pat Buchanan was an outsider, but he was an outsider from the political world, Pat Buchanan, he would have had connections, he would have been able to appoint people, whereas Donald Trump didn't have deep connections and probably wasn't even expecting to win, and wound up having to rely on a Republican establishment, to a large extent, a Republican establishment, and one that is largely dominated by neocons in the first place. And so he did have a neocon contingency in his cabinet. Of course, he wound up also, because of marriage relations, having a neocon contingent in his family, in terms of Jared Kushner and even his own daughter Ivanka. That doesn't help anything. And then after his inauguration, there was no breathing space at all. I mean, really, from day one, you had, for all intents and purposes, an impeachment movement started. January 21st, you had that giant pussy hat march in Washington, D.C., and it was giant, bigger than his inauguration. And you've had these demonstrations everywhere. You've had political violence, and you had problems with him getting his cabinet put in place. And then the sub-cabinet level appointments that still need to be, I mean, there's something like 400 or more sub-cabinet level appointments that need confirmation by the Senate, and the vast majority of them are still empty. He wasn't getting a team in place, and I think that he was overwhelmed. The media had a full-out assault on him. You had these Watergate-style hearings in Congress, which were on the back burner last month, but here this week we're going to see them in full swing again. And I think it made him vulnerable to a palace coup. That's my interpretation. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but I think that's the situation. And if it is the situation, one thing it does mean, one faint source of optimism would be the Trump presidency is up for grabs. Now, the people who are better positioned now are the neocons. The neocons left and right have united. The Hillary people who control the media and the traditional neocons in the Republican establishment, they've joined forces and they're running things now. And that was not what the election was about. I think perhaps Trump feels that the bulk of his base isn't focused on foreign policy and is going to give him a little bit of breathing space. It's a very worrisome situation, but the immediate result of it has been a complete 180-degree turnaround in foreign policy. And if you'd like to comment on my interpretation of the coup d'etat, feel free. But we've got at least three major flashpoints in the world, which could lead to World War III in very short order. So we've got Syria, the Middle East region centered around Syria. You've got what's going on in North Korea, and we need to talk about that. And then, of course, this old story of the Cold War, the revived Cold War with Russia, which is closer to a shooting war, really, than at any time since or even before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, yeah, that's basically what we're talking about here. And when we start prioritizing different things with Trump in terms of things he has done that seem to be good, he's made some recent pronouncements about this MS-13 organization, getting these people out of the United States. I basically support that.
Is that a Mexican cartel? A drug cartel?
Yeah, I think they're originally El Salvadorian in location. I did a radio show for RBN some years ago on this MS-13 organization. And when you start looking into things like that, Trump seems to be at least rhetorically on the right track with what he is attempting to do there. But when we start looking at this foreign policy front, my concern is that we are looking not at only one, but at three or four areas in the world where a single misstep could basically cause a global conflagration. Mm-hmm. And when you start looking at the statements of Tillerson, for example, when he was being confirmed by the United States Senate, the kinds of remarks that he was making before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in my view, and this view I think was shared by people like Pat Buchanan, was basically putting the United States on a collision course with China in the South China Sea for the Paracel and Spratly Islands, among mm-hmm. other things. And then, of course, the situation with people like Nikki Haley and the remarks that she's making about Iran and the remarks that she is making in recent times about Syria, where both she and Tillerson go back and forth on this whole question of whether or not we are seeking regime change in Syria. I have to believe that, in fact, we are seeking regime change in Syria after the events of April 4th and April 7th. So when you start examining that in conjunction with a increasingly frosty relationship with Russia, these statements that have been coming out of high places in Russia recently, exercising some degree of chagrin over the fact that we're now putting $800 million of new missile defense systems into Poland and Romania. The Russians insist, and I believe they're probably correct, I'm not an expert in this, but that in terms of the intermediate forces their treaty that we engaged in with them in the 1980s, that we continue apparently tramping all over that. We're talking about additional deployments of American and NATO military assets ever closer to Russian borders, all kinds of machinations going on with certain kinds of exercises in the Baltics, and nothing seems to have changed very much in terms of the Ukraine in regard to continuing to rhetorically pin everything on Vladimir Putin in regard to what has been taking place in the Ukraine and in the eastern part of that country, or the Donbass, as well as the Russian reestablishment of their relationship with Crimea. All of the rhetoric aimed at Putin on this conveniently ignores the fact that the United States supported an illegal coup d'etat which overthrew the legitimate Kiev government on February 2014. So the point is that when you start looking at all rhetoric coming out of Trump's key foreign policy advisors and national security advisors, and all of a sudden these very laudatory things that are being said about Donald Trump, again by such neocon radical Zionist superstars as Paul Wolfowitz and McCain and Lindsey Graham and so forth, this is not a happy picture that we are looking at. And again, how does any of this fit in terms of the so-called America First foreign policy, that cornerstone of what Mr. Trump campaigned on when he was elected? Clearly, when you are developing and deploying missile defense systems in Poland and Romania and getting Montenegro into NATO, when you have the bombing of Syria under what I consider to be fraudulent, false pretenses that are very, very reminiscent of the weapons of mass destruction rhetoric that was used to justify our illegitimate invasion of Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
And if anything, even more obviously fraudulent.
Yes, absolutely, obviously more fraudulent. And when we start getting into some of the things that you and I could talk about the specifics of what was said at the end of March by Mr. Trump himself, when he said that regime change in Syria is no longer a priority for the United States. We then go into this situation where this alleged use of chemical weapons by the Assad government on April 4th in this Khan Shaykhun area was followed then by the president's authorization of these strikes in Syria on April 7th. And when we start analyzing that whole situation, both in terms of who had the means and the motive and the opportunity, none of that points toward Assad. And then when you add to that what this Dr. Theodore Postol has mm-hmm. been saying from MIT on the subject of the way this whole thing looks to him from his very studied analysis of the situation, and here's a guy with all the credentials in the world to be a first-rate source and enabling us to try and grasp what did or didn't happen, none of this holds water in regard to the neocon mantra that Assad did this. Assad, in my view, did not do this any more than he was behind this chemical weapons attack in Ghouta that clearly was being used 3 or 4 years ago by key neocons and Zionists and the American government to justify a regime change American military intervention in that country at that juncture. So when you start looking at this whole business, it's extremely disquieting. And whether Trump has been a fraud from the beginning or has simply been co-opted and is trying to save himself politically by continuing to appease these people and these forces. In the last analysis, the conclusions that one draws about the likelihood of a wider war are not very reassuring in any way or any sense. You know, I just was jotting down this past week a series of titles of articles. Eric Margolis talking about the U.S. will break its teeth on Iran. Robert Perry's article on Donald Trump's failing presidency, which I might get back to briefly here in a second. Paul Craig Roberts talking about Trump being a cap of the deep state. And then, of course, Phil Giraldi, the longtime CIA station chief, correspondent for Buchanan's American Conservative, president of the Council for the National Interest, a most reputable, dispassionate intelligence analyst and respected columnist and journalist worldwide. He's certainly putting this into very, very disturbing perspective, talking about shambolic doings in Washington. Will we survive the next 90 days? And, of course, he's now reappeared. Dr. Giraldi has, as I have been for a number of years, as an informed critic of this Mujahideen-e-Khalq, M-E-K, or MKO organization that actually tried to kill my father in Iran some 40-odd years ago.
Really?
Yes. My father was the head of Lockheed's operation called Peace Logistics. He'd been over there for a few years, but he was promoted to being the head of Lockheed's logistical support operation with the Imperial Iranian Air Force, which at that juncture was the largest defense contract that American company had with the Shah's government back in those days. Well, of course, this was all preceded by a series of MEK assassinations of a couple of American colonels whose funeral I attended over there, a Colonel Turner and a Colonel Schaefer. Later, they assassinated some Rockwell International employees, and they had been at work for a long time, killing other Americans in that country and also killing key people in the government as well. And as Giraldi was pointing out in this TASNAM News Agency interview that he granted recently, and I was interviewed by that same agency not long ago, this MEK or MKO organization has killed at least 17,000 innocent Iranians in that country, most of those since the revolution took place. The MEK is thought to have been directly involved in gassing Kurds in Halabja at the behest of Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. The MEK has been very, very involved in recent years in working with the Israeli Mossad. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Giraldi makes this very clear in the Tasnim interview that the MEK, as far as he's concerned, and of course as far as he's concerned, is still a terrorist organization. But the fact that they're now working with the Israeli Mossad in trying to overthrow the current government in Iran underscores the fact that all of these American politicians and national security figures who took money from the MEK to promote getting them delisted from the State Department list of terrorist organizations tells us that the wider story of who and what it is that's running the foreign policy of the country, and that has increasing influence, or so it would seem, with the Trump administration, mm-hmm. which, again, is not what any of us who voted for Trump thought we were getting.
Does this MEK have any links to particular American politicians or American political forces?
Yes, and that chiefly the Israeli lobby. And there are a couple of good sources to turn to on this. The Rand Corporation, I think, still has a position paper out there on the MEK, which goes into the entire history. It is a so-called Islamic Marxist organization, quote-unquote. It's a very strange group ideologically. It formed in Iran in the 1960s among student leftists who were in those days trying to coalesce against the reign of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. There was this strange Islamic twist that they tried to incorporate into their Marxist ideology. And as Giraldi points out in this Tasnim interview, the MEK, headed up by Miriam and Masood Rajavi, this married couple, is largely a quasi-pseudo-authoritarian religious cult as well, which exercises cult-like control over its members in a fashion not dissimilar, in my view, from what you had with Jim Jones in Jonestown back in the late 1970s. And in this regard, the MEK, interestingly enough, after the end of the Pahlavi era in Iran, the successor government in that country decided, I think correctly, to boot the MEK out of that country. So then the MEK, having been at work against the Pahlavi regime for years, suddenly turned its guns and its subversion onto the present government in Iran. Again, they were linked to the utilization of chemical weapons against Kurds and Halabja during the Iran-Iraq war at the behest of Saddam Hussein.
Also, that's a big part of the pretext for the Iraq war was Saddam Hussein gassing his own people, even though
exactly.
The Defense Intelligence Agency chief, our Defense Intelligence Agency chief at the time, told Congress that the weapons were not consistent with Iraq, Saddam Hussein's stockpiles. So you're saying that it was the MEK, this Iranian
yes.
opposition group. Do they get funding from the United States or the CIA?
I don't have the proof, but I would suggest very strongly that they do, and I would suggest that Israeli intelligence is very much involved in this for a couple of reasons. One, if you go back and look at the news articles that were in the mainstream New York Times at the time of the delisting effort to get the MEK legitimized by our State Department, when you look at all the national security figures and all of the domestic American politicians that were receiving money, and the figures are printed in the New York Times, receiving money to promote these people and to promote their removal from the State Department list of terrorist organizations, there is a striking virtually one-on-one connection to Jewish elements and to pro-Israel elements in this country, politicians doing Israel's bidding. Another thing that's quite fascinating is that when you look at Newsweek magazine, which, of course, is about as controlled a publication as you can ask for in this country in regard to mainstream pro-Zionist corporate news, the Newsweek all but admitted that it was the MEK who carried out the assassinations of these Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran in recent years, largely at the behest of Israeli intelligence.
Wow, okay.
So, I mean, these people are bad news, and as a matter of fact, Dr. Giraldi, a former CIA station chief par excellence, currently working for the American Conservative, antiwar.com, head of the Council for the National Interest, he makes a very strong link in his interview with Tasnim News Agency between the MEK and the Israeli Mossad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to North Korea,
sure.
Being that it's so much in the news now. You were interviewed recently on Press TV, and you made the point that North Korea is not a threat to the United States. And I'd like to talk about that. And one point I'm going to make right now from the get-go is North Korea has been remarkably stable since its founding in 1948. So over the past 69 years, got the same party in charge, it's got the same family in charge, it's been remarkably stable. It's had shifting alliances between the Soviet Union and China going back and forth, but it wasn't going back and forth because of its own instability. It's been going back and forth because of events in those countries, because of instability in those countries. And that stability, I think, is also linked to a predictability. I think it's very predictable. But you were making the point that it's not a threat, so maybe you'd like to elaborate on that.
Well, to me, as I look at this whole situation, it seems to me that when we look at North Korea, and Justin Raimondo, I think, has a clinching argument on this and what he wrote recently for antiwar.com on the subject, we go back to a particular historian who is the head of the History Department at the University of Chicago.
Yes.
Who opens up for us.
And
with
that's Bruce Cummings.
Right.
Well, I've met him a couple of times, and I endorse him very strongly. Somebody that the Trump administration should be consulting with. But please continue.
For sake of time, we're trying to boil this thing down to its essence. You have Dr. Cummings telling us that between 1945 and 1948, unbeknownst to most Americans, the United States was very much involved in supporting a South Korean strongman by the name of Syngman Rhee in South Korea, and that Rhee's police department and military were disproportionately staffed with South Koreans who had been full collaborators with the Japanese occupational regime during World War II. And the United States' support of Rhee, many Koreans saw this as an intervention in their country's affairs that should not have been going on, and it actually strengthened the hand of the North Koreans, who were quite adept at reminding people of the Japanese occupation of Korea, and that the United States was actively working with these Korean collaborators with the previous Japanese government in South Korea. The other thing that Dr. Cummings emphasizes is that Harry Truman had plenty of advance warning of this impending North Korean attack of South Korea, largely as a result of policies that we had been pursuing for 3 years. Truman basically got the United States involved in this situation militarily in Korea without congressional authorization. And you had two Republican politicians at the time, the very well-known Senator Robert Taft of Ohio was one. The other one was a Republican congressman from Iowa, whose name suddenly escapes me. These guys were looking into this thing in terms of, okay, let's find out what the president knew and when he knew it, borrowing a phrase used later by Howard Baker in the Watergate hearings, you know, what really has been going on here? And is this really in the interest of the United States to be involved in Southeast Asia in what looks to us like a civil war? What have we been doing in that country for the last 3 years that has been concealed from the American public? And last but not least, this whole business of Truman not having any advance warning of this attack. We want to see the stuff that he and some others are sitting on that has not been declassified, that should give both houses of Congress a better picture of just what it is that we're being dragged into. Well, of course, when one starts looking at things that way, and then looking at the situation that occurred in the Korean War for 3 years, 1950 to 1953, and then subsequently everything that has happened since, we are now at a point where, as Armando has pointed out, we are actually in a situation where whatever we think of the current ruler of North Korea, the attempt to preempt him militarily to, quote-unquote, take him out is virtually a guarantee of at least a theater nuclear war in that region. There's no way that North Korea has a weapon for the foreseeable future that can reach the continental United States or even Hawaii. Most recent missile tests, I think, underscore the fact that his prowess in regard to nuclear weaponry is greatly overstated by the elements that want a war in South Korea or want a win Korea. And having said that, I think that there is some understandable concern, however, on the part of Japan that they conceivably could be hit by something coming from North Korea. But then, as Raimondo points out, the most vulnerable people are the folks in South Korea that we are aligned with, and that if we attempt to preempt this guy in the North militarily, it virtually guarantees not only the utilization of nuclear weapons, but our South Korean allies are quite likely to suffer conservatively at least 1 million casualties out of that, not to mention ecological disaster that would take place. And so once again, it seems that we have a situation where you start looking at the whole history of the relationship that the United States has had with Korea since 1945, whether we're talking about what took place between 1945 and 1948, or we're talking about more recent events. I would imagine that Dr. Cummings would agree with Raimondo that much of what has resulted in this current impasse is the result of the classic American foreign policy of interventionism and setting up the stage for something that over the course of time, meaning in some cases decades, results in a virtual guarantee of some type of conflagration that when it takes place is going to be absolutely seismic. Right. So Buchanan has even made the point that if the South Koreans had any sense at all, they would get our 28,000 troops out of that country and start talking about having the United States and Russia and China chiefly, and of course the other elements in the UN Security Council, at trying to talk this thing down and result in policies that might conceivably get this thing at least stalemated without the eventuality of a nuclear involvement. But when you start looking at the rhetoric coming out of Trump and Tillerson in recent times, and of course these American naval deployments and so forth, it's not a good situation.
It's not a good situation. It's interesting that Pat Buchanan would be calling for the removal of America's troops. You said 28,000. Historically, it's often been closer to 50,000. I know it's been drawn down somewhat. You mentioned Japan being somewhat vulnerable. And of course, the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, who has been Prime Minister since 2012, I don't think he has a great deal of popular support. I think it's just a situation where there's not alternatives to his party that are seen as viable. But he's tried to make a mark by being a nationalist. But instead of being a nationalist standing up for Japanese independence by seeking the removal of the 40,000 or so American troops, 40 or 50,000 that have been in his country since World War II, he's been a nationalist by rattling sabers against North Korea and against China. And now that those chickens are coming home to roost, it's not a good situation. I've heard that the Tokyo subway system shut down because of the testing of this most recent missile, that they shut down the subway system for 10 or 15 minutes, which is a big deal in a country like Japan that's so reliant on public transportation. The outgoing, recently impeached South Korean president, Park Geun-hye, she has been rather belligerent. It's a shame that you had 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago, you had a sunshine policy that was seeking some sort of accommodation with North Korea, and it was very promising. But that's gone by the wayside, largely because President Bush, for whatever strange reason, in that speech he read in the 2002 State of the Union, referred to an axis of evil and threw North Korea into it. You know, the Jewish Canadian David Frum was the person who actually had written the speech. Very strange. But you touched on some of the history of the North Korean-American relationship and South Korean. I'm just going to augment it a bit. This character, Syngman Rhee, was a very elderly when he became president of South Korea at its founding. He was supported by the United States. South Korea, had there been elections, it would have been won by communists. One communist faction or another would have won. That's just the reality. The Americans did not want a communist government in South Korea. They supported Syngman Rhee. Syngman Rhee did not have popular support. He had emigrated to the United States, or actually to Hawaii, which at the time of his immigration, I'm not even sure if Hawaii was part of the United States yet. I know that in the 1905 Portsmouth negotiations, negotiating the end of the Russo-Japanese War, Syngman Rhee was present as a representative of the Korean population that was being fought over, because Korea had been under a lot of Russian influence, and as a result of Russia losing the war, Korea was annexed by Japan. Syngman Rhee had already emigrated from Korea at the time. He had been outside of Korea for well over 40 years, probably more like 50 years by the founding of the state of South Korea. When he was parachuted in, his Korean wasn't even very good. He hadn't had much practice speaking it in so long. And so he was not somebody with a lot of popular support. You mentioned the Japanese collaborators in the South Korean government. When Syngman Rhee, after 10 years, was pushed out after a brief interlude, you had a military coup and led by Park Chung-hee, who is the father of the outgoing president, Park Geun-hye. That was her father. He wound up being a military dictator for 18 years. And what was his background? He had been one of the elite officers in the Japanese army. Although he was an ethnic Korean, and most Koreans were very bitter about the annexation of Korea, he had graduated near the top of the class of the Tokyo Imperial Military Academy. And this is at a time of World War II. So talk about collaborators. That was the history. And of course, one other thing that Bruce Cummings and some others will recount is during the Korean War itself, the amount of munitions that were dropped on North Korea were just off the charts. Way more napalm was dropped on North Korea than on Vietnam. No country on earth up to that point in history had ever been bombed as thoroughly as North Korea. And yet, we're supposed to assume that, oh, bygones are bygones, and the North Korean government, the same family that was ruling the country at the time, would have just forgotten about it and, you know, forgive and forget. And it's not like that. The North Korean state is very oppressive, but in terms of international relations, just because they have an oppressive political system within their own state doesn't mean that we can do whatever we want to undermine them. That's okay. It doesn't mean that. And then finally, in the 1990s, early 1990s, I guess it was 93, the first year of the Clinton presidency, he was on the verge of bombing North Korea, and Jimmy Carter intervened, went over to North Korea, and this again was based on their nuclear potential because they had a nuclear power plant that was a Chernobyl-style nuclear power plant and one that they could have extracted plutonium from to make a fissionable nuclear bomb. And the outcome of the Carter deal was that Chernobyl-style reactor would be mothballed. Chernobyl reactors are graphite-cooled, which is not a very safe way of doing it. Not that nuclear power is safe in any way, but the replacement would have been a heavy water-cooled reactor that would be safer, certainly, than the Chernobyl-style one, and it would also be under the monitoring of the International Atomic Energy Commission. And so that was the deal. It was supposed to be operational by 2001. Well, ground had not even been broken on it by 2001. And then after putting North Korea in the axis of evil, North Korea winds up withdrawing from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is their right, and restarting this mothballed reactor, which again is their sovereign right, whether we like it or not. It was their right. So we're trying to impose rules and conditions on them that are not part of international law. They have not violated international law by signing the treaty and then dropping out of it according to its terms, giving 1 year notice, and then starting up their reactor. This is stuff that is their sovereign right, whether we like it or not. And if we don't like it, the way to deal with it is by negotiations and one-on-one negotiations, which they would welcome. And there's no reason why there can't be some sort of coexistence. And personally, I would hope that at some point North and South Korea reunite, but it's not our business. It's up to them. But we shouldn't be obstacles, and we have been obstacles.
Well, you know, when you stop and think about it for a minute, several things come to the fore here. And the napalm statistics that you cite are well worth underscoring. I don't think the average member of the American public has any idea about any of that, much less the level of ordnance was that we dropped in the Vietnam War. Second thing that comes to mind here, of course, and this was cited by the North Korean president himself, what about Israel? This is the thing that comes up constantly with these states that have any type of nuclear capability whatsoever.
Did Kim Jong-un, did he cite Israel?
Yes.
That's,
I mean,
amazing.
He basically, in recent statements that I have seen in the international press, was saying, hey, look, the United States is trying to hold us to its version of what we do and do not have a right to. What about Israel? And I seem to recall that the North Korean president made reference to Israel as some sort of an international renegade or outlaw, you know, that kind of rhetoric. But at the end of the day, this comes up constantly with nation states that are well aware of the fact that Israel has all the nuclear, biological, and chemical weaponry in the world, that it continues to violate international law in all kinds of different ways, including its present policies both in Gaza and in the occupied territories, that the United States continues to subsidize these people to the tune of billions of dollars a year, and including the new $38 billion supplemental portion of the Israeli military budget on top of what they already get. And other people around the world are looking at this and going, and they're not even a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Yeah, this comes up constantly.
If I could interject for just a second, while Israel, it's their right not to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, what is totally banned and illegal under the Non-Proliferation Treaty are countries like the United States and Britain and France and Canada to provide any assistance to any nuclear
exactly.
assistance to a country that's not a member, and they are not a signatory. So
every dime that we are giving the Israelis as a non-signatory to the NPT is a violation of law.
That's right.
Every dime. And of course, none of this is mentioned for obvious reasons in the American mainstream press. Does the American corporate media or any of these neocons in our government, and thus the American citizenry as a whole, even that watches the news for 5 minutes from bad sources, grasp that there is another side, whether we want to admit it or not, there is another side to our involvement in Korea between 1945 and 1948. We've already referenced that with reference to Bruce Cumings' two-volume set. I understand that in that two-volume set, he basically chronicles the fact that over a three-year period of time that American forces helped to basically kill 60,000 Koreans in that country, well before the whole issue of a North Korean invasion of the South came up during the Truman administration a couple of years later. So as much as we were snickering with ourselves in terms of what we did in Iran in 1953 with Operation Ajax, only to discover the level of blowback that occurred not only 25 years later, but that has continued to occur in the almost 40 years since the end of the Pahlavi regime in that country. Mm-hmm. So we like for people not to understand the historical context of any of our dealings with these countries, of any of our covert and sometimes not so covert support for some elements that end up putting all kinds of policies in these regions that our names are attached to that are anything but good, that end up producing a tremendous amount of resentment of us around the world. And of course, it seems to me that in terms of this current rhetoric over North Korea, that there's a lot of Manichaean dualism that comes up in the rhetoric of Trump and Tillerson and Haley and so forth, where it's the old good guys, bad guys routine. We're wearing the white hats. They're wearing the black hats.
Right.
We're the Lone Ranger and Roy Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy, and they're the guys that have robbed the train or have abducted the people or have killed people and so forth and so on. But we don't do things like that. Well, any responsible historian, including Dr. Cummings, can provide us with the evidence that that ain't so.
That's right. And one other reference I'd like to provide before moving on to Russia, which I guess will be our last issue. There was a very well-known journalist in the 1950s named I.F. Stone. He was a Jewish leftist, but he wrote a book in the midst of the Korean War called The Hidden History of the Korean War from 1950 to 51. Of course, the war went on to 53. But he documented, in ways that you can confirm, very clear evidence that this was not a surprise attack, that there is absolutely no way that the Americans, that the South Koreans, or their other allies should have been surprised by the attack. One thing was the cornering of the, I believe it was the soybean market, by Taiwanese, by the Kuomintang, the Chinese nationalists. And of course, they were still technically in charge of all of China, even though China was in the Civil War. But they cornered the soybean market, knowing that a war in Korea was going to disrupt the exporting of soybeans from Manchuria. That's something people can check. Now, while we still have time, I'd like to go to what is probably, I mean, these Korean or the Syrian issues, they could blow up into a World War III, but it only becomes World War III when the United States and Russia fight against each other. I mean, I suppose China's getting to the point where we could worry about that, and you're free to throw China into the mix if you want, but we've got this week the re-emergence of these Watergate-style hearings in Congress. They're going after, if not Trump as directly as before, but they're certainly going after the Trump administration. They're going after General Flynn because he accepted a speaking fee from RT. Or speak in foreign countries. Not at all unusual. In my case, we're talking about four figures at most. Certainly, I've never broken five figures, everything added up together. But be that as it may, it's not unusual. And to see Representative Elijah Cummings, who is one of the ranking members of one of the committees that's going to be holding hearings, talking about this clear violation of law and how improper it was for General Flynn to have accepted a speaking fee at an RT event and have his transportation paid for. Congress, virtually every member of Congress goes every few years on these all-expenses-paid junkets. Well, they go all over the world, but especially to Israel. And Israel, if you look at it, I mean, when was the last time Russia attacked one of our ships and tried to sink it? Like the Israelis did with the USS Liberty. And, you know,
exactly.
The level of Israeli spying is as great as Soviet or Russian spying ever was. It's enormous. And they have a doctrine, they have this, please help me, the journalist who uncovered the Samson Doctrine.
Cy Hirsch.
Yes, Cy Hirsch.
Yeah.
You know, they have a hostile doctrine. It's just people aren't very aware of it. And Elijah Cummings himself, he receives money from this Jewish organization in Maryland to spread around to black high school kids in his district to send a dozen or so of them every year on all-expense-paid trips to Israel in order to foster warm and fuzzy feelings between the black community and the Jewish community. So he's getting all of this money from Israel, all of this support from Israel, and yet he's jumping up and down about how treasonous it is for General Flynn to have accepted a speaking fee, to have made a speech in Moscow. So basically, this is, people are using the term McCarthyite, this is kind of a witch hunt to keep anybody who has any inclination to have any kind of detente with Russia, to make them ineligible for government service.
Well, that's right, and I think Phil Giraldi has put this into proper perspective. He said, I don't remember exactly how he put it in one of his recent articles, but the idea was, well, Before we really get into Russiagate too much, what about Israelgate? And I'm sure that Dr. Drowley would say the very thing that you're saying here, that whether you're looking at the Levant Affair in 1954, or you're looking at what many of us believe was an Israeli link to the Kennedy assassination in 1963, their provable deliberate shooting up at the USS Liberty in 1967, then, of course, there's the Pollard spy case that comes up. There are a series of other spy cases involving Israel that have transpired over the course of my lifetime. You start getting into the called Promis Affair, which the British writer Gordon Thomas has chronicled in his book Seeds of Fire.
And what's that, the Promisius Affair? What is that referring to?
The Promis Affair, P-R-O-M-I-S. The Promis Affair basically involved a security software that had been developed legitimately by a relatively small American company based, I believe, in Maryland. And basically what you had was a situation where that Promis computer software computer chip was being used by American domestic and federal law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies for all of their communications and so forth. And what you had was a situation where Rafi Eitan, the Israeli spy who was very much involved with their science and technology division, came to this country. He posed as someone else. He purchased this Promis computer software from the owner of this company. And basically, the Israelis then proceeded to doctor it, and doctor it in a way that put some sort of a backdoor device in it that would enable them to read the computers of other groups and individuals that were using their doctored version of the software. And then it became a question, of course, of ensuring that their doctored version of the software was going to be installed in places that were useful to them, including our Los Alamos nuclear laboratory, where Gordon Thomas presents us with a compelling case that Israel and China were collaborating there and siphoning materials out of the American Los Alamos National Laboratory system. And then, of course, when we understand how this device was brokered and that it involved Robert Maxwell, the British media magnate who was working for the Mossad, arguably later killed by the Mossad, by the way. That's another story that you can find out more about online. But that basically Robert Maxwell was working with American politicians like John Tower, the late John Tower of Texas, who died in the most mysterious way, of course, that this was how this whole plot was enacted by both Israeli intelligence and the Chinese.
Now,
so, again,
I don't want you to get off on too many tangents, but
sure.
John Tower, he was a senator from Texas, had been appointed by Bush as a Secretary of Defense, wasn't it, by the first Bush? And,
yes.
And his friends in the Senate didn't confirm him. Now, you're saying that he died under somewhat mysterious circumstances?
I conclude that after reading Gordon Thomas's evidence. I did a review of Thomas's book, by the way, Seeds of Fire, which is quite dated. But if you search my name and Gordon Thomas and Seeds of Fire, it'll come up. And it's very interesting that John Tower and the United States Senator John Hines up in Pennsylvania
who died in an airplane crash.
Apart in separate aviation accidents.
How about that? Was
yes.
John Tower at all anti-Zionist?
No, I think the connection would suggest the exact opposite, that John Tower was apparently on the board of directors of several defense contractors that did a lot of business with Israel, and I'd have to go back and take another look at the book review I did of Thomas's book, Seeds of Fire, which goes into this. But it sounds like the brokering of this doctored Promis software to the Los Alamos laboratory involved both Robert Maxwell, who had a very close link to John Tower, by the way, and that Tower, as I remember what was in the Thomas book, did a very fine job, if you're rooting for Israeli intelligence, in making sure that Los Alamos installed a version of that software that was the very one that Rafi Eitan and the Israeli LACOM intelligence agency dealing with their science and technology division had doctored up so that they could be involved in backdoor surveillance.
And then finally, do you see any prospect for a detente with Russia? Is there anything out there you see as a hopeful sign?
I just hope that some sanity on the part of Mr. Trump takes place, not to mention some of his advisors. I'd been extremely hopeful that when Trump was elected, of course, that we would see at least a better day in terms of U.S.-Russia relationships based upon mutual interest.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to like, and I think you've been pointing this out throughout the show, But we're talking about Vladimir Putin, who I do have some regard for, a lot of regard for, as a matter of fact. Or we're talking about the president of North Korea that I have much use for, but nonetheless is a player in the scene. Where there is mutual interest, there has to be a way for getting things resolved. And if you look at the situation in North Korea, just as one example, the United States, Russia, China, North Korea, and South Korea, and Japan, just to name a few, have a mutual interest in not radiating the landscape over there in this dispute. So if people would just keep shut in regard to talking about all options being on the table, this sort of thing coming out of Pence and Tillerson and Haley and so forth, and if we simply can get together with the Chinese and the Russians and with the North and South Koreans and the Japanese and get together behind closed doors and say, look, we've all have been malefactors in this at some level over a very long period of time. Won't delve into too much of that except to acknowledge that everybody here has got some blood in his hands. What do we do to resolve this so we don't blow ourselves to Hades?
Right.
I think a little of that would go a long way, not simply in North Korea, but dealing presumably with a far more sane regime in Russia when it comes to militarizing their borders, being involved in these nefarious operations that we've been involved with in their southern underbelly in Ukraine, various things going on that we've been a party to historically with South Ossetia and Georgia and the Donbass and so forth and so on. We need to knock that stuff off. And the other thing, clearly, I think there is no reason for any of the things that we've been doing in Syria in recent times since Trump's election. It seems to me that it would have worked out very nicely to declare victory, to get out of there, and to let Putin and Assad continue to mop up the floor with these Wahhabic extremists. That suit me just fine. And if we showed some good faith in Syria, that might go a long way toward restoring some confidence with the Russians that our new president would do something about some of these lunatics at NATO that want to militarize Eastern Europe and threaten Mr. Putin on his own territory. There's no point in that whatsoever.
Well, Mark Dankoff, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And if you like what you hear, please go to nationalbugle.com, click on the donate button, and send us a few dollars. Please join us again next week for another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Here's a postscript. This interview with Reverend Dankoff was recorded on May 1st. On May 2nd, President Trump and President Putin had what was, by all accounts, a very constructive telephone call in which it seems that they may have reached some understanding about how to move forward in both Syria and North Korea. We will have to keep our fingers crossed.
This is a public service announcement from TakeFromCaesar.us. Only one statute explains how to tax your paycheck, Tax Code Section 83. In decisions from 1979 to 2011, the courts say Section 83 governs the taxation of all compensation for personal services, but the IRS lies on the stand, claiming to be unfamiliar with Section 83. Only one person can explain what Section 83 means, David Merlin. Visit TakeFromCaesar.us for more information.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of seven herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now, and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Roberts & Roberts Brokerage believes that every
the number two, keep it today.
Hi, my name is David Merlin from takefromcaesar.us. Income is defined in the tax code. All property is a cost, including labor, according to statute. You're deprived of the provisions of Section 83 whenever you pay an income tax on your compensation. According to Section 83, only the excess over the amount paid is gross income. The government can't so much as provide an interpretation of Section 83 of its own. Get your paradigm shift and understanding today at takefromcaesar.us.
People who hate us and want us dead. My theory of white advocacy is that you're not going to win debates with the people who want us dead. What you're going to do is give white people the tools and the morale and the sense of worth that they need to fight for themselves.
So changing the narrative, even if it doesn't change the minds of blacks, for instance.
Well, change the minds of whites.
If it changed the minds of whites.
I'm fighting for the minds of white people. Okay. I'm willing to concede the minds of blacks. Forget that. But I want to try and win the hearts and the minds of white people. It's white people who...
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.